This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It's crucial to mobilize capital for those investments, but where's that money going to come from? We're facing a global debt crisis. In these situations, these innovative arrangements have developed.
That's Rebecca Ray, senior academic researcher with the Global Development Policy Center at Boston University on so-called debt for nature swaps. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. is connecting small business owners to companies in Africa, and refugees and conflict experts see little hope of an end to the fighting in Sudan. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Minority-owned American businesses interested in exporting to Africa have been introduced to potential partners in Nigeria, Ghana, and South Africa. This is part of efforts by the U.S. government to deepen trade and investment on the continent. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
U.S. Undersecretary of Commerce for International Trade Marissa Lago says the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden created the Global Diversity Export Initiative less than 2 years ago. Speaking from Nigeria during an online media briefing Tuesday, Lago said it is geared towards exposing minority-owned businesses in America to overseas markets. She said the 20 U.S. companies and organizations that made the trip were mostly owned by members of the African diaspora in the United States. However, other groups such as Native American and women business owners were also represented.
These companies are active in a wide range of sectors, starting with the Information and Communications Technology Center, cybersecurity, electric vehicles, energy, trade facilitation, and consumer goods.
Lago said they began the 9-day trip in Johannesburg, South Africa, where they met women business leaders and asked them about challenges and opportunities there. In Accra, Ghana, they participated in the inaugural U.S. Ghana Business Expo, hosted by the American Chamber of Commerce in Ghana.
This expo featured a trade pavilion that was buzzing with exhibitors from the companies on our trade mission, but also about an additional 20 U.S. companies that already have a presence in Ghana. And they were able to showcase to the Ghanaian business community their innovative products and services.
Lago stressed that in each of the three countries they visited, tech was very much front of mind, including a recent gathering of computer programmers. David Green is the chargé d'affaires for the U.S. Embassy in Nigeria. He said with the creative youth population in Nigeria, tech opportunities are everywhere in the country.
Nigeria's home to Africa's largest democracy, population, and economy. And we really believe that Nigeria's economic growth will bring stability and prosperity, not only for the Nigerian people, but also across West Africa, where Nigeria is such an economic heavyweight, through cross-border expansion and economic integration, including under the African Continental Free Trade Area.
The African Continental Free Trade Area Agreement aims to gradually reduce intracontinental tariffs on 90% of goods, which could increase continental trade income by $450 billion by 2035. Lago said that since President Biden hosted the African Leaders Summit in Washington, D.C. in December and the U.S.-Africa Business Forum, 75 new deals between the United States and African countries have been closed. They are worth an estimated $5.7 billion. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town, South Africa.
Gabon has closed on Africa's first debt for nature swap, an arrangement that is predicted to generate $163 million for marine conservation over the next 15 years, while reducing the interest rate on what the country owes outside banks and investors. Rebecca Ray, senior academic research with the Global Development Policy Center at Boston University, monitors so-called debt for nature swaps. She tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that Africa is the first place to start such an arrangement with a marine conservation element.
Debt for nature swaps are innovative mechanisms whereby a country that really needs to and knows it needs to invest in long-term environmental sustainability so that it can safeguard the livelihoods of traditional communities against warming oceans, against rising sea levels, to ensure their livelihoods, can afford to mobilize capital for those investments by exchanging some of its current debt obligations with easier debt obligations that go towards a blue bond or a green bond that supports specific conservation projects that can help safeguard those traditional livelihoods.
And this is important, especially for Africa, right?
It's absolutely crucial for any country that's facing the impacts of climate change on local livelihoods. So whether you need to safeguard fishing villages against the impacts of warming oceans or safeguard traditional hunting and inland fishing communities against deforestation, in any of those situations, it's crucial to mobilize capital for those investments. But where's that money going to come from? We're facing a global debt crisis. In these situations, these innovative arrangements have developed.
What kind of, when you get down to the actual nitty-gritty of it, what are they doing with the money to try to safeguard these fishing villages?
Well, Gabon's debt swap is going to fund the development of an ocean conservation plan. And so the specific projects haven't been identified yet. And that's one of the innovative factors in this particular arrangement. Because Gabon is facing debt problems right now, it doesn't have time to spend several years developing sustainable livelihood plans for coastal villages at the moment. It needs debt resolution immediately. By being able to proactively fund the development of an ocean plan and then commit to funding those projects once they've been identified, Conservation International, the U.S. Development Finance Corporation, and Gabon have committed to ensuring that those investments are front and foremost in their debt resolution process.
But I mean, do you know what they would actually do on the ground or in the water, as it were, for trying to sustain this kind of livelihood?
I can tell you what the Seychelles did. And if Gabon follows that approach, we might see really fruitful projects come out of it. In the Seychelles, the approach involved several years of deep interviewing with traditional fishing villages to find out which aspects of marine biodiversity were most crucial to their livelihoods, and then to safeguard those coral reefs, those estuaries that were so crucial for them, against international trawling fleets that would come in from international waters and exploit those fisheries. So if Gabon were to follow a model similar to the Seychelles model, we might see the beginning of a process of deep interviews and community consultations to find out how best to safeguard traditional livelihoods against warming oceans and increasing international trawling fleets.
So do you think this is the start of a wave of debt for nature swaps in Africa, in other countries?
Well, I think we've seen marine debt for nature swaps really grow in popularity since the Seychelles pioneered them. The Seychelles began with one that was just $22 million, and at that time, that was a tremendous amount of money. But very recently, Ecuador pursued one that was over $1 billion.
That was Rebecca Ray, senior academic researcher with the Global Development Policy Center at Boston University. She was speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam from Boston. Niger's military leaders today said 17 of its soldiers were killed in an ambush by insurgents, the deadliest attack since the military took power in a July 26 coup d'etat. The defense ministry said the ambush took place yesterday about 60 kilometers from the capital Niamey in a southwestern area that borders Burkina Faso. The ministry said Niger forces killed 100 attackers. Niger, like other countries in West West Africa Sahel region has been struggling for years to contain an insurgency by groups linked to Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State that have killed thousands, forced millions to flee their homes, and caused food shortages. The perceived inability of civilian governments to overcome the problem has been one of the factors in a string of coups in the region, including in Niger. Also, in Niamey, Nigerians are preparing for a possible invasion by countries in the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, which has said it will use military force if the junta does not reinstate deposed President Mohamed Bazoum. ECOWAS's military officials are to meet in Ghana Thursday and Friday to discuss plans for such a mission. The Niger junta says it may try Bazoum for treason. Timothy Obiezu in Lagos reports on ECOWAS's reaction to the charge and what it could mean in terms of either a military intervention or diplomatic solution to the Niger crisis.
Regional bloc called the attempts to bring charges of high treason against President Mohamed Bazoum provocative and said it contradicted the coup leader's recent willingness to pursue a peaceful resolution. While calling for his immediate release and reinstatement, ECOWAS emphasized that Bazoum remained the country's legitimate leader. Niger's military junta spokesman, Major Amadou Abdourahmane, announced the charge against Bazoum in a televised address Sunday. Abdourahmane said Bazoum had undermined Niger's internal and external security and that he had been communicating with high-ranking regional politicians who are, in Abdourahmane's words, trying to truncate the peaceful resolution of the crisis in Niger in a bid to support a military invasion. The plan by coup leaders to try Bazoum for treason came hours after they agreed to hold talks with ECOWAS. An ECOWAS spokesperson did not respond to calls for comment, but political analyst Rotimi Olawale says Niger's junta is using Bazoum to strengthen its hand in negotiations with the regional bloc.
The military junta are using every tactic in the book, one, to claim legitimacy to power in Niger, but also as bargaining chip in the conversation and discussion with the regional body, ECOWAS, and with the wider international community. Treason is something that you would see many countries pull up as accusation one way or the other. But I'm sure it's part of the negotiation strategy of the military regime to find soft landing for themselves.
Soldiers of the Presidential Guard overthrew Bazoum on July 26th and have since held the president and his family hostage. If found guilty of high treason, Bazoum could face the death penalty. On Monday, the U.S. State Department criticized the plan to try Bazoum, warning it will worsen tensions in the region. Chris Kwaja is a senior researcher at the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He says the junta has no legal standing to pull off a trial because the military government is illegitimate.
For the same government that is a product of unconstitutional means to use the law in prosecuting Bazoum, you cannot give what you don't have. What we see the regime doing is an exercise of naked power. It is unconstitutional. They cannot exercise authority when they were not given that authority by the people.
ECOWAS has taken a tough stance on the coup in Niger, including border closures and asset freezes in a bid to restore constitutional order. Olawale says there's a possibility the junta, which has suspended the country's constitution, may retain the function of the judiciary for Bazoum's trial.
If they go to court and they prosecute him under treasonable felony, to hold him under the Niger constitution. But I don't think it will get to that end. I feel that pressure is mounting on the Niger regime. They have not received external support.
Last week, ECOWAS authorized activation of a regional standby force to reverse the coup if talks with the military government fail. But experts say the force could take weeks to assemble. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Medical workers say the worst fighting in Libya in months killed at least 45 people and wounded more than 140. However, it appears a truce reached Tuesday night is holding. The clashes between the 444 Brigade and the Al-Rada, or Special Deterrence Force, erupted Monday night in Tripoli and raged through Tuesday. There are two of many militias that have vied for power since the overthrow of longtime ruler Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. News agencies report the fighting was triggered when the Al-Rada force detained the head of the 444 Brigade, Colonel Mohamed Hamza. Late yesterday, an agreement was reached with Prime Minister Abdelhamid Dabiba, head of the UN-recognized government in the capital, for Hamza to be handed over to a neutral party. A ceasefire followed, and late Tuesday the fighting abated. Both armed groups are aligned with Dabiba's government, one of two rival administrations competing to control Libya. Some regional analysts say Sudan's conflict has reached a stalemate, both militarily and diplomatically, with little hope of a swift end to the war. Meanwhile, those arriving in South Sudan, having just fled from Khartoum, described the city on the verge of collapse. Henry Wilkins reports from Jodha, South Sudan.
A few hours earlier, Niall Anfar crossed the border into South Sudan and returned to the land of her birth after fleeing the fighting in Khartoum. During the journey, she gave birth to a baby girl. She described the city on the verge of collapse, with parts of the population under bombardment. She says aircraft were firing missiles over people and gunshots. She says her neighbour was also shot while she escaped the city without even taking any clothes with her, adding her neighbour was shot along with her three-year-old daughter. Many people who fled Khartoum told VOA they are hoping for a swift end to the conflict so they can get on with their lives. Some analysts say a narrow window for dialogue about stopping the fighting in Sudan may have opened. A report last month from the International Crisis Group, a Belgian-based research group, said the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, had gained an upper hand over the Sudanese armed forces, the SAF, in Khartoum, suggesting the SAF may be more willing to come to the negotiating table. According to other analysts, the window may have already closed, if it ever existed at all.
I would not agree with assessments that some have made to suggest that either the RSF was about to take back control of Khartoum. The future of the country depends on there being only one national army. And I just don't see how we can get there through a kind of political process that folds in elements of the RSF into the SAF.
Before the conflict started, attempts were made to merge the once friendly, now warring military factions. Diplomatic efforts to get the parties back on the same side have so far been unsuccessful.
What's problematic about this is that one side will always see one of these tracks as being biased. So unless we have one very strong, broad coalition of international partners that can come together in a way that doesn't is not perceived as being biased.
Daniel Dain, who has also recently fled from Khartoum, says he does not know how long the conflict will last.
Life in Sudan become very bad for us, especially with South Sudanese. That's why we decided to come here so that we can go to our homeland. So up to now, we don't see this situation whether it will end because all houses were being burned. So they are also, they have killed so many people.
Dayen says he dreads having to rebuild his life in the ruins left behind by the war. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Jodah, South Sudan.
Namibia's Parliamentary Standing Committee on Natural Resources recently took a coastal tour to study the impact of seal populations on fish stocks, visiting Walvis Bay and going on to one of the largest seal colonies in the world at the Cape Cross Seal Reserve. Vitolia Angola reports from Walvis Bay on what they learned.
Namibia's growing seal population is seen as a threat to the sustainable harvest of fish, one of Namibia's largest income earners. In March, opposition member of parliament, Mike Kaveketora, tabled a motion seeking government intervention to curb the seal population. However, environmentalists have raised red flags regarding the proposal. They argue that depleting fish stock is a result of overfishing by human beings and not necessarily overconsumption by fish. Operations manager at the Fisheries Observancy Agency, Victoria Orasmus, chaired a meeting with the parliamentarians on Wednesday.
We need enough data to see how much of the catches are the seals taking from the fishers. What is the level of predation? Because we cannot thumbsuck this. We need numbers. We need figures. For the industry to simply say the seals are taking from them, the fishers, mind you, are also taking from the seals. Because these fish, the seals have equal right to predate on the fish. So we first need figures, we need numbers, we need research to be done. Only then we can draw concrete conclusions.
Naude Dreya is a co-founder of Ocean Conservation Namibia, a non-governmental organization that focuses on creating awareness of the importance of seals in the marine ecosystem, especially relating to ocean pollution. He cautioned that seasonal harvest cannot bring down seal numbers. That's because there's no market for seal products locally or internationally, and therefore no incentive for hunters to kill the seals. Dreya says the alternative of large-scale culling could draw negative publicity to the country.
Do you guys need to take into account as well, or do take into account the negative impact something on this scale would have on the tourism in Namibia too? It is a huge sector. And you've seen the outcries, you saw how much media there was regarding the harvest. We've seen the effects at Cape Cross. We visit Cape Cross quite regularly, especially during the harvest time.
According to Dreher, tourists are avoiding visiting Cape Cross since the 5-month seasonal harvest of seals began on the 1st of July. It is set to end in November. Chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee on Natural Resources, Chekero Tweya, is adamant that a solution needs to be found to decrease the number of seals in Namibian waters.
The fishing quotas have been decreasing over the years. The fishing companies themselves have invested in the infrastructure and they cannot maintain. What do? They reduce the staff to maintain those infrastructures. And that's the reality. These facts are there. So for now, we really just first concentrating on the seals as a contributing factor affecting this other sector.
The annual quotas given to fishing companies have decreased over the years, and there have been moratoriums on commercial fish stocks such as sardines to allow for reproduction. For VOA Africa, I'm Vitalio Angula in Walvis Bay, Namibia.
The United States government today barred three Democratic Republic of the Congo public officials from entering the country, alleging they were involved in significant corruption. The State Department listed the individuals as Kosama Wilungula Balongilwa, Augustine Ngumbi Amuri, and Leonard Mwamba Kanda. All three are former officials with the Congolese Institute for the Conservation of Nature. The State Department alleges the three men, instead of protecting wildlife, trafficked in endangered species such as chimpanzees, gorillas, and okapi, primarily to China. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Nicole Peters, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.